Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to The Hobcast. It is show number...
86.
It is. I'm pretty sure it is.
I was pretty sure it is this week.
And I've been drawing up plans for show number 100, trying to think of ways that we can make it really special.
Oh, 14 weeks, that's what? Three months.
Pretty much Christmas, isn't it?
Yes. We should make it very special and Christmassy.
Yeah, we should. I've got an idea. Anyway, welcome to the show. This week, we have the wonderful Rachel Sargent joining us. In fact, we joined her specifically.
Yes, but only a few hours ago.
Yeah, we've had a whistle-stop visit to Gloucestershire to visit the Painswick Rococo Gardens, which is the scene for the opening, sort of key scene in her new book for us, Her Deadly Friend, which comes out on Tuesday. And it's not the only book that we've got coming out on Tuesday, is it?
I know, we've got another one. Bullets in the Sand.
By A.J. Aberford.
Yes,
which is the second of the George Zammit series. So we are extremely busy this week, as you can hear. We'll talk about that later. But welcome to the show. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together, well, you know what we do. We run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Crime.
Mystery.
And... suspense.
The other one.
Yeah, the other one is its name. And we are proud to be the publisher of 23 different authors, which is fabulous. Some still to come out, but most of them now in print. When we get Rachel across the line on Tuesday.
Yes. Well, we've still got authors who we haven't published yet coming across the line fairly soon.
Yes, Rob Gittins.
And Maureen
Myant as well. Very exciting. And plenty to look at our website, www.hobeck.net. We're going to crack straight into the news. Only a couple of things we want to discuss. While you're talking about this first story, I shall dig out the other one.
Okay. So this is a story close to my heart because in 1998, I think it was, I got my first job in publishing, my first full-time official job in publishing. I'd done some temping and maternity cover before that.
Yeah.
So my first job in publishing in 1997 was as an assistant editor at Oxford University Press, and my salary was $13,000 a year. I remember it distinctly because I remember thinking, well, that's not that much, but I'm doing something I love.
Mm.
So I was... And I was starting not quite at the bottom rung, the editorial ladder. You can be an editorial assistant and an assistant editor. So I was starting as assistant editor. And I remember being a little bit disillusioned the first week because all I seemed to do was photocopy. And in fact, my very first job, I was given this enormous wad of paper, which was the Oxford Companion to Turner, and told to make three copies.
Good boy. Cool.
But it wasn't just a case of feeding the photocopier.
No.
Because the authors had stapled edits.
Okay. Right.
So, the point is, there's an article in the bookseller about how young people entering the publishing industry now are actually opting to leave, which, you know...
So they're not sustaining, you know, they're interested, I mean... I lost count of the number of people I met, say, when I was doing some volunteering with Exeter University in terms of careers advice. Everyone wanted to go into publishing.
Yeah, it's a thing that a lot, across the Atlantic as well, in America, you know, it's like seen as a dream job. If you love books and you love reading and you love language and you don't think you're going to make it as a writer, what do? You become a publisher.
Yeah. So what this article is saying is that the cost of living crisis, the cost of living in London, and the low pay, the extra hours they're expected to work in terms of reading manuscripts in their own time, unpaid overtime, essentially, is putting people off at the first rung.
Yeah, because they just can't afford to do it. And I can remember as well, that expectation that you clock off at, I think the official hours for me, it was 9 till 6, but I would get in at 8 and I would leave at 6:30, 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
That was normal. And you would take work home with you to read.
Yes, of course. So they're rejecting this current deal, the expectation, not waiting to get further up the ladder, where presumably at some point they might start making a living. I'm not entirely surprised by this. I mean, I think the publishing industry itself has woken up to this in terms of trying to find a way to provide accommodation at, so buying, for argument's sake, somewhere to put interns and new people in the industry up in London that is funded by the industry itself. But that's just a small gesture and a small token. The fact is that realistically, I think that, if mother and father were subsidising, Johnny and Tabitha to go into publishing, that was fine. And there are a lot, that's why it's kind of a self-selecting thing. We've seen it in London Book Fair. There's a certain type of person who comes into publishing with a certain type of accent and a certain type of education. And that's probably why, because economically, unless mummy and daddy are able to support you, you can't make a living.
Well, this is a problem I had when I graduated from Exeter. I knew there were a lot of my contemporaries who were doing not just in publishing, but any sort of creative employment upon graduation. They were able to either commute from their family home, which tended to be in the home counties.
Yes.
Or they had someone, a relative, a friend or a relative that they could stay with in London.
Yes.
While they... Yes. Earned enough money to get there first.
Well, if publishing is serious about diversity, it needs to sort this out.
Well, I had no chance. So no. I went back home to Stafford and I got a job as an administration assistant for a locksmith part-time because that's all I could get. And I was very disillusioned and very... the system upset me. I didn't know anyone in London or anywhere near London to stay with. So
I totally understand it. My first job, even though it was in Exeter, I was earning £9,900 a year in 1995 as a graduate with a journalism qualification. And my take-home pay was about £600 a month, of which, half of it went on rent.
Yeah, so you were doing it for love.
Yeah, it was a start. It was a foot in the door. I mean, I got to the BBC shortly after that and, it got a bit more reasonable, but I was still living in a caravan for the first 6 months. Because I couldn't afford to, I wasn't on a long enough contract to find anywhere to stay because I couldn't take a 6 month rental because I didn't know I was going to be in the job week to week.
No.
I was on 0 hours effectively. Each week they'd tell me if they wanted me to come back. And eventually I got a contract and I was able to sort of find bricks and mortar to live in. But again, it was one of these things where if my parents hadn't had a caravan, it was a miserable winter. The olive oil froze. It got that bad. if I hadn't had that option.
That shows your class, that.
Yeah. The olive oil froze. It couldn't just me. It was awful.
I couldn't have my salad.
I was in a riding school on the Hog's Back near Guildford. Anyway, I'm not surprised. And, the industry has been exploiting people for generations and it's time they woke up to it. And it's true. I mean, there is this chasm. So all of the major publishers boasting about, 20% increase in this, that and the other, revenues up. Everyone's making record profits, all that, la, 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 la. And yet the bottom of the rung are not seeing any of it.
And that's where the future talent is as well. So they need to take care of those people.
They do. Indeed, they do. Right, the second story we're going to touch on before we speak to Rachel is an article in The Telegraph. And it was a sort of thought piece, I suppose, that I read. And the headline is Why Amazon is Prime Target for Cancellation as Households Cut Spending. And this is about Amazon Prime. And the fact is that Amazon Prime membership in the UK has fallen by 590,000 in the second quarter of this year. And that's according to research commissioned by the media regulator Ofcom. Now, of course, Amazon Prime offers for currently, if you're paying monthly, $7.99, the fast delivery service on pretty much every product they sell. You have to look for the Prime logo, but nonetheless, pretty much next day delivery. And in some places like London, same day delivery.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you get Amazon Prime Video. You get access to some of Amazon Music. You get Prime Reading. You get to borrow stuff from the Kindle Unlimited library as well. And there are magazine subscriptions on there. There are all sorts of benefits you get from being a Prime member. It's a pretty good package. But the economy has tanked worldwide. And in the UK alone, 590,000 people have withdrawn. And that is further information. So Netflix lost 210,000 subscribers year on year. And so essentially, it is indication that people are just cutting the extra, you know, the flab, the stuff that they like to have but don't need. And of course, this will have an impact to some extent on what's available for us as publishers in terms of the number of people within the ecosystem borrowing books and getting a page reading income. And in fact, this month we have noticed that our page reading income has become a smaller proportion of what we make in sales. It's about, it has been as ahead of sales in terms of revenue. And now it's fallen to a proportion of about 56% for ebook and paperback sales, and now 44% for Kindle Unlimited reading. So that, I think, is an indication that you know, fewer people are using that service.
That's basically a sign.
It is. It is. And I think that this is also, Amazon Prime, they kind of lose money on it, but they're about to put the price up as well, so which I'm sure will hasten this decline in subscriber numbers. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and it doesn't sound much, does it? Is it $7.99? I should know, because I have got Amazon Prime.
So Amazon is poised to increase UK prices on September the 15th by £1 a month, meaning that the annual subscription will go up, apparently, from £79 to £95. Well, that doesn't quite work out mathematically, but nonetheless, a quid extra, so £8.99 would be the... So that could hasten the decline. And, you know, and it makes us wonder whether we go wide and publish our ebooks across a number of other platforms like Kobo, etc. like that. But, you know, as yet, Kindle Unlimited income is still a very big proportion of what we're generating, and some of our most popular books are generating, you know, 3,000 to 5,000 page reads a day on a really good day.
Yeah, so it would be a risk.
It's a big risk, but something we need to be aware of. I mean, you know, there's no question, as we keep saying in this podcast for the last few four or five weeks, really, that I think everyone in publishing expects there to be a squeeze because it is discretionary. I mean, it is one of those things where it's not an essential. If you can't heat your home, you're not necessarily going to be going out and buying books. I've always thought that Amazon Prime offered a fantastic deal if you can afford, you know, to find that $8.99 a month, as it will be from September the 15th, for the level of entertainment that it's offering.
Yeah, and also, like you were talking about, the free postage and that it's coming the next day. So people don't just buy books on Amazon.
No, of course not. You know, but they are suspending their Amazon groceries service as well, which also suggests that people are stepping away. So they were rolling it out across the piece, and that's been stopped a little. They're halting it for now. So lots of indicators to suggest that, you know, everything's not quite as rosy for Amazon as it has been.
No.
Okay, let's get to our signature interview for this week. And I know last week we promised you Zoe Sharp this week.
That was my fault, completely my fault. I got a little bit befuddled. Zoe is actually coming on next week.
Yeah, so we spoke to her this week, and it's a great interview, wonderful. If you wanted to know about how to basically kill somebody with a biro, she's your woman. In fact, any household object can be used as a weapon in the hands of Zoe Sharp.
And I can't wait to try some of the things out.
Watching out now. But anyway, Zoe is coming next week. So this week, it's Rachel Sargent, who, as I mentioned earlier, is releasing Her Deadly Friend, her first police procedural suspense novel, with us at Hoback Books. And previously, she has been published by one of the really, really big publishers. And she's still with them for her psychological suspense novels and psychological thrillers, but has come to us with Her Deadly Friend. It's set in a semi-fictional city of Gleevum. And that is loosely referred to. It's Gloucester, but it's the it's a fictionalized version of it. And as part of that, very close to Gloucester, is the Rococo Garden at Painswick House.
Absolutely lovely place. So
gorgeous.
Please go and visit, listeners. You'll love it.
It's up on the, you know, as the Cotswolds roll away from Cheltenham and Gloucester, you get Painswick just before you reach Stroud. And it is spectacular, Rococo Garden. The only one still existing in the UK, apparently. And it is the scene for the opening murder of this book, Faith, Her Deadly Friend. And so it was an absolute delight to meet Rachel for the first time
and
in person.
And Mr. Rachel.
And Mr. Rachel. Nigel, thank you very much for your hospitality today. Let's speak then to Ray Sargent. I'm trying to quote from an English country garden, but none of it's coming to mind, apart from the rude version.
What is it? Oh,
in an English country garden.
It feels like we should be able to quote from an English country garden.
I know, but we had a rude version when I was about 7 years old at school, which involved in pants and ants and things like that. So we won't repeat that. But anyway, let's welcome our guest to this wonderful garden. We're in the Painswick Rococo Garden, which is close to Stroud, Gloucester, Cheltenham, in the Cotswolds, basically. Beautiful spot up on the hills. And we're with Rachel Sargent. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for coming all this way to see me in my local garden.
I was going to say.
Your garden.
Yeah. My personal garden.
Yeah, you must put some effort in to keep this thing going.
a couple of hours a week.
Where do you get the time for the writing? I don't know, but anyway. What a beautiful spot. And you've been coming here for years, so you've seen it evolve and develop.
Yes, it has. It's changed an awful lot. The people who run it and volunteer here have put so much effort into it to build it up, make it an attraction for all the family, not just for garden enthusiasts, but somewhere that children can come as well.
There's actually quite a lot of people here today, aren't there? Yeah. All ages as well. And
it's amazing. And we're looking on the, what do they call it? The Excedra garden. Am I saying that right? On the right-hand side. Yeah. It's kind of formally laid out. There's some towering sunflowers just in the distance.
Yes, I love
but it's beautiful, and all these little pagodas and we found ourselves a lovely curved bench, which makes it perfect for having a podcast guest. So
can I just ask a question? I'm not very good with trees, but what type of trees are these?
Well, they're apple trees.
They're apple trees.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Can you see the apples actually growing on them, love?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, they're going to have a really lovely
Just about. Yeah. I can.
You might need to run up and have a look. Yeah, I mean, they look like Granny Smiths or something like that, by the look of it. Eaters, anyway, rather than cookers.
And a fairly new feature here. You see the long grass. Mm. They've done a bit of rewilding here. That's now planted with hundreds of daffodils. It's been planted in the last 3-4 years, I would say. So if you come in spring,
that is
the most amazing display of daffodils. So that's one of the developments we're talking about, developments we've seen over the years. That's certainly one of them, and it is absolutely fantastic.
Well, you can understand why you would do that. I mean, that brings visitors in March, just as the ground is beginning to firm up a tiny weeny bit after a hard winter, perhaps. You're going to come and have a look at the daffodils.
Yeah.
And then
the bluebells.
Yes. Well, the garden's mainly known for its snowdrops in January and February. That's the big pull for this garden. Traditionally, that's what brings people here. But they very cleverly started to plan a whole year of visitor attraction. So they've got the daffodils in March. Then they've got the bluebells, which I'm sure we're going to talk about a lot more because of my book.
Yes.
So they're really developing it. And then in the summer, as you can see, we've got all the beautiful summer flowers to our right and the sunflowers, as you mentioned, in the distance.
Yeah.
And then in the autumn, apples.
Yeah. Yeah, they do a special apple day with events for children in, I think it's late September, early October, they do that.
Oh, that's lovely. Mm.
Well, we are here to talk about a book. We're talking about Her Deadly Friend, which is your first Hoback book with us as Ray Sargent, writing as Ray Sargent. And as they proudly say in the gift shop, because it's already available, even though it's not published yet, it's available in the gift shop here. The first chapter is set here, albeit under a different name.
Yes.
And let's get into the thrust of the plot. There's a murder.
Mm-hmm. You have to say that in the Scottish accent.
There's a murder. Or indeed, I could do it in a, I know, Gloucestershire
go
accent.
On then.
Murder. That's terrible, isn't it? murder. And that's the inciting incident that kicks off Her Deadly Friend. which we're exceptionally excited about publishing this week. So take us into the story. We have somebody being murdered by the name of Krista. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a dark start, obviously. You know, you want an inciting incident to be dark. But I think what's very interesting with this, with your story, is the way that it sweeps up so many people bit by bit.
Mm.
And it kind of catches you right, you know, all the way to the end. You're thinking, right, could they be it? Could they be it? I love that.
Yeah.
Was that your inspiration in terms of writing your first police procedural like this?
Yes. What I was really going for was the suspense side. So you've got the whodunit. Yes, there's several murders and you've got your police trying to track it and work out who's done it. But what I also wanted was a sense of suspense. So you've got the whodunit, which is what has happened.
Yeah.
But you've also got the suspense, what will happen. And we don't know what will happen because our lead detective, as well as investigating all the crimes, there's something, someone from her past who is being linked, albeit very tentatively, to several of the crimes. So she's having to investigate this person from her past all the time, thinking to herself, am I doing this because the evidence points this way, or am I doing it because I don't like this person?
Yes.
And we also get to hear the story from the viewpoint of that person. The person's called Amy. It's an old school rival.
Yeah, Amy Ashby is the
Amy
character.
Ashby is the rival. The main detective is Steph.
Steph Lewis.
She's the detective inspector. So we see the story from both viewpoints, and Amy also is unhappy with what's going on, and we don't really know for most of the story what Amy's connection is with the crimes and what she's hiding. Mm.
But what I also like is the way that both Steph and Amy, they've got their present life at the beginning of the book, but then when this happens, when they get involved in the story, they're thinking back to what they were like before, and they're thinking back to how they got to where they are now, and it makes them sort of reevaluate things.
Well, I think it's interesting. You start with a twist. The key twist here within that relationship is that you've got a detective inspector who was a bully at school and made Amy's life a misery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that she starts to, this is Steph, Steph Lewis is starting to wrestle with a sense of guilt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of her prime suspects is the woman, is the girl that she tormented at school.
Yeah.
But she also feels there's an inciting incident in the prologue that she was being unfairly treated by the school.
Yeah.
That she was being blamed for everything bad that ever happened to Amy was her fault.
Yeah.
And the dreadful mother of Amy always pinning the blame. What are you going to do? What are you going to do to sort these girls out, these horrible girls? And so there's this sense of injustice there as well, which has driven her forward, presumably, into the police. So you've got, you know, you've got a detective with whom we have some empathy, but at the same time, we know deep down she wasn't always honourable.
No. And at the start of the book, she's pretty well forgotten about her past. She's pretty well sorted at the beginning. Mm. She's a detective inspector. She has her own home, a lovely flat in a nice area of Glevham. She lives with her 17-year-old son, who's doing well at school. Her parents, who are nicely off, run their own businesses. They live on the other side of the city. She gets on well with all her colleagues. She's respected by her chief inspector. And things are pretty good for Steph at the start. But by the end of the novel, she's perhaps not in such a good place.
No.
And she's moving into book two. She's going to have to face some serious memories, really, of all kinds of things, some connected with Amy, some not. She's going to have to deal with a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of the that opening scene, though, look at the cover, which is another Jane Mapp masterclass. What was the thinking behind the cover? So what we've, I mean, I'm no good with flowers, so what are we looking at here? These are bluebells. Bluebells, right?
The bluebells from the gardens behind.
Yeah.
Right behind us on this bench where we're sitting,
yeah,
there is a bluebell glade. Mm. And my scene, my fictional scene in my fictional gardens, the Georgian gardens, I wrote in right behind us, in the Bluebell Glade, which is a newish feature here at the Painswick Rococo Garden. It's something they're developing, and it grows year on year, as flowers do.
Yeah.
And my inciting incident takes place in that Bluebell Glade.
I feel a shiver coming down my spine now.
But I love that, though. The fact, you know, the flowers are beautiful and they're sort of pure, aren't they? But you have this sort of gritty event that happens there.
Yes, yes. And normally in there you've got sort of just a light chorus of birdsong in the background, but at the time of the incident, the birds are going bonkers.
Oh.
They're going absolutely bonkers.
They sense the approaching danger.
They do. Yeah. I was talking about this with my boys in the car the other day, actually. We were talking about how when there's an eclipse, everything goes silent, or when there's a thunderstorm, you know, you have a feeling that the thunder's coming because the bird life and the insect life acts differently.
Yes.
Because they're sort of in tune to these sort of vibrations, whatever. Mm-hmm.
And, I love that. Yeah, absolutely. I think you, your world of Cleavon, it's, can we say where it's based on?
Yes, it's based on Gloucester. The name is based on the Roman name for Gloucester, which is Glevum, G-L-E-V-U-M. So I thought I'd call my city Glevum, but as you pointed out, it didn't really sound like a very modern city name. So changed the spelling to Gleveham, G-L-E-V-E-H-A-M, which is immediately sounds like a proper city or a proper town.
Yep.
So it's based on Gloucester. The reason for changing the name really is because I have fictionalised it. I've moved places around. Well-known landmarks in Gloucester are not where they normally are. I've also imported some from other places. There's a pub appears in it, which is, last time I looked, was in Shrewsbury.
oh, which pub's that?
The Armoury.
Ah,
I haven't called it that in my book. But,
they do good food there.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot of playing God and moving stuff around in fiction. So I needed to change the name because anybody who knows the real Gloucester is going to think, well, she's never been there. What on earth? That garden.
So you basically avoid that happening and people saying, oh, that's not there.
But I also wanted to, I don't mind making the connection. In fact, I'm encouraging the connection because I think it's nice for people who do know Gloucester to read it and think, oh, I bet she's based that
on... Yeah, there's an echo of this and then, you know, oh, I bet that's that. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So
absolutely.
That's the idea.
Yeah, and you know, when we were discussing this switch, because when we were presented with the book, it was Gloucester.
Yes, yeah.
There is that other thing that hangs over the city still, for those old enough to remember.
Yes.
Murders.
I mean, there are murders in every city, and I'm writing this book for entertainment. It is just for fun, and I mean absolutely no disrespect to real people who have been the victims of crime and other families of victims of crime. There's no entertainment in that at all, and that's another reason for really making the distinction between a real city with real people and this fictional world I've created for entertainment.
It is. I mean, you know, this is something that we touch on the program quite a bit, but it is weird that, particularly in Britain, we just love a good murder, fictional one.
Mm.
The real thing will acres and acres of space dedicated to the ones that really resonate. I mean, there are lots of them going on that don't resonate, but, you know, you think of when I was living in Cambridge, or at least afterwards, we had the Soham murders, and that was months and months of coverage. And it is extraordinary, and the sort of the depths of anger and resentment and that build up across as a sort of collective feeling, and yet we'll escape into a book where people are getting bumped off.
Do you know what? I think it's because we like puzzles.
I was just going to say that for me, it's the puzzle.
Mm.
But there's no sense of shame at enjoying a puzzle because it's fictional.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's why we like fictional murders, because we know nobody's been hurt at all. There's no harm. And we can enjoy the puzzle, solving the puzzle.
Well, yeah, but don't... Here's another question, though. Isn't the whole point of the thing? We should actually feel some impact by some of the deaths because we've followed those characters and we're... Perhaps...
Well, what I've tried to do is show the characters before they're murdered. So we see a little bit of their backstory, their moment in time, so that we do feel some sympathy for those people. And then I have not shown the actual murder particularly.
No.
So there's nothing from the viewpoint of the killer showing them getting any kind of pleasure from the crime. So I'm hopefully not sensationalising the crime, and I am generating sympathy for the victims by showing their life, just a snapshot, prior to their deaths.
Yes, yeah. I mean, that makes those deaths land more...
Well, I hope so. Yeah. But it is, as Rebecca said, I think it's the puzzle. Mm. I think it's the puzzle that excites us, and hopefully the suspense of it.
Yes.
And also getting inside people's heads. I think we love to try and work out what's going on in someone's head, whether it's, you know, a murderer victim or the murderer themselves. We just want to... I don't know, we just love that sort of the psychology of...
Yeah.
And I think that's true in your book and a lot of our books, is that, you know, you can actually see how ordinary people with solid backgrounds and, you know, all the things that, you know, that we take for value as a, you know, steady life and nice car and nice house, whatever, can suddenly, through one thing changing in their lives, become those people who commit murder or, you know...
Or who are murdered.
Yes.
And also changing the lives of everyone around them.
Yes. That impact.
Well, this series of murders is going to change Steph, my detective's life. When she went to work that morning, all she was worried about was the fact that she'd just had a day off sick because she's not really very well. The story takes place just after the early May bank holiday in 2018. So she's had the May bank holiday off, but she spent the whole thing in bed because she's been poorly.
Yeah.
And she's had to have an extra day off. So this is the Wednesday. And really all she's thinking about is she's got to shake off this illness before her son starts worrying about her. And she's got to get to work to solve this first murder. She's no idea what she's driving into because she drives up to these gardens. The second chapter is set at these gardens when she arrives at the crime scene. And we see the garden viewed through her slightly cynical eyes because she's not really interested in the garden. She's trying to get to the murder scene. And she has no idea what's about to happen.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because she starts off as this robust, strong character. And events affect her, but also physically she started to crumble a little bit.
Yes.
You know, there is this thing hanging over, which, like so many of us, whenever, you know, a consistent pain, and in this case it's her head, she has terrible headaches, doesn't she?
Yes.
You just put it down to, I'm stressed. Oh, I haven't drunk enough water. I haven't, you know. But it's 2 weeks, it's 3 weeks, it's whatever.
Yeah.
And by the end of the book, we're not quite addressing it yet, really, are we?
No.
In Steph's life.
No, you know, it's something to carry over.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's very human.
But it's very human, because I'm sure most people have had something like that. You know, it's a niggling, like you say, it's something niggling, and you think, you get really frustrated because you want to get on with your job and your life and everything, and you don't want to be... laid down for it, and then you think in the back of your head, you're thinking, should I do something about this?
Yes, and you were worried what that might, if it isn't just a niggle, you don't want to face that, so you put that off.
We were so excited when we got your submission because I recognised your name, and we'd met kind of.
We'd seen you on the stage,
We'd seen you on the stage,
and I'd read your book because I bought the book.
Thank you. It was Morecambe and Vice, wasn't it?
That's right. So that was our first contact point. It was, you know, funnily enough. A couple of other authors as well have come along the way through that as well, so which has been wonderful. But in terms of your where this sits in your career, and this is obviously a departure from what you've written before for another publisher, what was the attraction in coming into this genre?
I really wanted to do something that combined police procedural with suspense, and it was the suspense bit that's always what interests me. My previous books have been suspense, but I wanted to create a series. I've never really done that before, so I wanted the puzzle element, the whodunit, but I really, really wanted this suspense. So I was so pleased when you were a publisher, because a lot of publishers don't like that sort of hybrid.
No.
They want, you can write suspense or you can write whodunit, but they don't really want the two together.
It's really strange, isn't it? Because we both of us really like that combination. Because another book we've got coming out in November is very similar in that way. That's The Confession by Maureen.
Is that
Mines.
Maureen's? Yeah. I'm looking forward to reading it. Can I review it, please?
Yes, you can. I'll send you a copy now if you like.
Thank you. Yes, please. Yeah, I'd love that.
That's a cracker as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I know you're right. I mean, there is that danger. Look, these publishers are longer established than us and have figured out the angles, but we're trying to break that.
So. Well, I think that's good. I think that's absolutely fine. That's great. I don't have a problem with that. Let's have a new publisher come along who twists the genre a bit. You're specialising in crime, mystery, suspense, and I can't remember what...
Thrillers.
Thank you. Thrillers. That you've said, right, this is us. This is what we're doing. So within those subgenres, we're trying new things out. We're twisting it. We're taking on new authors. And that's great. That's your brand.
Yeah.
So it's really great for me to be part of that brand and have the opportunity to write this suspense stroke police procedural.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have every faith that, as ever with these things, it takes time to build up momentum or whatever, but that it will be successful. I think that when it boils down to it, when we read it, we went, cracking story, got to publish
it.
You know, that's what it boils down to. And, you know, name value was obviously, you know, initially it went, oh, I'm sure I've heard of Rachel.
Oh, I knew straight away. I recognised her name. I was like, book's over there. I've got the book.
Yeah. But in terms of... obviously, you've been this path before, in the sense of, you know, we have published first-time authors, but you're an experienced author with a big publisher. And what lessons have you learnt over that journey, do you think?
I think you've just got to write the book you want to write. I am published by a big publisher as well. It's no good just trying to write what you think the publisher might like. It's got to come from your heart.
Yeah.
So I wanted to write this hybrid book. I really wanted to do it. I really wanted to do a series. I knew it wasn't really going to sit well with them, but I just really, really wanted to do it. And I think you've got to. You spend 2 years writing a book. You've got to love what you do to make it the best it can. It just wouldn't work if you didn't.
Mm. And in terms of, you know, working in that industry, the things that have been surprising to you? Did you have expectations as to how publishing would work, and then that's the reality has borne that out or not?
I don't think I really had any expectations. What I've found interesting is to be told what my brand is and what my genre is, because I didn't know until I was published. I thought I just wrote crime. And it's being told, well, no, actually, you're writing a psychological thriller. I'd never heard of a psychological And so now I understand a little bit more about all the subgenres. Mm. I thought if it's got a body in it, it's crime. That was as much as I knew, you know.
But you actually raised an interesting point, because I think publishers get a bit stuck in their heads in that they assume everybody knows what a psychological thriller is. But does the average reader think, oh, I read psychological thrillers, I read police procedurals?
I think some...
Because I didn't know the terms
no.
before.
No, I think some people do know that that's their thing. But actually what they're judging it on, if they look at the cover and go, oh, it'll be that sort of thing. And that's what really... This is one of the restrictive things about covers, in the sense that you know, we could have done what everyone else does, is put
woman in a red coat disappearing in the
distance. Steph Lewis in a red coat walking through the Bluebell Wood or something, you know, and that would have been, you know, everyone would know exactly what we're dealing with then.
But I also think that would pigeonhole it more as police procedural and less as thriller.
I think possibly.
I mean, I'm not an expert on this. You know more about this than I do. But whereas this cover, I think, is much more your suspense
type
cover.
I mean, because we did do some research looking at comparable covers and authors on Amazon, and that this is definitely a sort of an idea, a concept, this sort of suspense.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the tagline again, because I remember when we, you know, collaboratively we came up with it.
Yes.
The closer she gets, the more people die.
you know, have to have that voice, though.
You have to have the trailer voice. A woman, you know, one woman. identifying as a woman. No, in the modern day. Anyway, that's fascinating, isn't it? That you know, that there are these nuances that we all obsess about in the publishing industry, and yet the punters will either like it or they won't.
Yeah.
And that's our job as publishers, and together with you in terms of publicity, is to try and find those people for whom it resonates and they're going to recommend it and say, you've got to get this book, which, you know, it's sometimes a hit and miss affair, but, you know, we always start with great faith and confidence that it's all going to work out. But what about your writing process then? When did you start committing yourself as a novelist?
Oh, well, it's a funny old thing. It was 1999.
Yep.
I was at a party. It was quite a posh part, a bit of a ball thing, really. I had a posh frock on.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes at these big parties, they'll have table guests going around, sort of magicians or...
Oh, yes, I know, sort of thing, yeah.
Well, they had a palm reader going around. So I thrust my palm at her, and she said, "Ooh."
Not a good start.
She said, "Ooh, you're very creative." And I said, No, I'm not. Oh, yes, you are. Do you play the piano? I said, "No, I'm tone deaf. Don't play the piano." So she's still holding my hand at this point. She won't give it back. She said, "Oh, what? No, you're definitely creative. Are you an artist?" "No, I don't know one end of a pencil from the other. Not an artist."
Right.
"No, you're definitely creative. Have you ever done any writing?" And I went, "Oh, well, I used to like writing at school." "Oh, well," she said, "I think you should write a book. You're very creative." So we got there in the end. And I actually took this and I swanned around for 6 months going, "Do you know, I could be a writer." Didn't do any writing, but I could be a writer.
Yeah.
And then I was living in Germany while all this was happening. Mm. And then I moved back to the UK, moved to Shrewsbury, and they were having their first ever literature festival.
Ah.
And there was a writer called David Armstrong who was giving a workshop on writing crime. So I went to it because, you know, I could be a writer. Do you know that?
Well, yeah, because it's written.
Yeah. Your palm says so. Yeah.
So I went and he set as an exercise. We had to write about somebody chained to a chair in their own house because they'd been kidnapped and what was going through their mind. Mm. So it was just a 5-minute exercise. So I wrote my thing and we had to read it out in the class. And everybody was really complimentary about mine, including David Armstrong. I said, "Oh, it's really good." So I went out of that workshop to walk down the road in Shrewsbury, went into a shop to buy a drink because it was a hot day, and there was a copy of Writing magazine on the shelf. I'd never seen Writing magazine. So I thought, well, obviously I am a writer
now. So you need to buy it.
So I bought this magazine,
yeah,
and inside was an advert for the Crime Short Story Competition, their annual Crime Short Story Competition. So I decided to write up this 1 5-minute paragraph as a short story. Sent it off and it won the competition. My first ever short story won the crime writing short story competition.
Yeah.
And my prize money paid for me to go to Harrogate to collect my prize. So I thought, yay, this is it, I'm a writer. I mean, it actually was I didn't have a lot of success after that, but that initial getting that first,
that validation,
that made me keep going through the next few years when I didn't really get anything. But that was, so in answer to your question, where did your writing journey start?
That's amazing.
That was it.
That's a fantastic
So if
one.
I ever see that Dutch I need to buy her a pint.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, my broadcasting journey started on my tour bus, my very first tour. And this Scottish guy came up to me, goes, "You got a great voice. You've just got a great voice for broadcasting. You should go into it." And I went, "Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you." No, I really mean it. You really have a great voice for broadcasting. You know, take my word for it. I know what I'm talking about." Anyway, I thought nothing of it, really. You know, I was thinking, it lands a kernel. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. What do you do when you're studying for ancient history? You know, whatever I was doing at the time.
Not a lot.
Failed my A-levels and all that sort of thing. And it turned out, then I watched a show called Fame Academy. I can't remember when it was.
Oh, I remember Fame Academy.
You know,
yes,
so
I
think, what was his name? Lamar came out of that. And the headmaster of the Fame Academy was a guy called Richard Parks.
Yeah.
That was the guy on the bus.
Oh, my goodness.
Head of Capital Radio.
What bus was this?
This was an open-top tour bus around Cambridge. When I was 18, I did my first...
Oh, you were the tour guide?
I was the tour guide on the
and
bus.
And he happened to be on the bus as a member.
And I didn't realise who it was, but it was one of the most influential people in the radio industry.
Yeah.
Telling me that I should be a broadcaster.
Wow.
And so that was, you know, I wish he'd offered me a job properly then, but as you are, you know, this is how these things can start.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, from there on, I decided that's what I was going to do. And, you know,
You are in the garden.
I am, yeah. But that's a fantastic story. I mean, that really is.
I love that. I mean, I had a similar thing. I had my palm read when I was in Japan. Not quite so exciting as that, but the guy did say, he said, "You're going to settle close to where your family are." And at the time I was in Japan because I wanted to be as far away as possible. And I was like, no, you're wrong. I'm not going to go back to Staffordshire. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to live there. I'm sorry. You're wrong.
And where are you now?
Staffordshire.
Yeah. Isn't it strange?
Where have you dragged me?
Staffordshire.
The cultural desert as I know it. No, I mean, that's fantastic. I mean, in terms of then, you know, the years where it didn't quite work out, what kept you going?
What kept me going was that first win, that my first ever short story won a national competition. I thought, if I can do this, I can really can do this. And having such ridiculous confidence, I decided to expand this short story, which had originally been the 5 minutes. Expanded it into an 80,000 word novel. And somehow or other, I managed to get it published. I got it published by Robert Hale, who are no more, but they published it. So again, that was another confidence boost. But I reached the point, I think it was about between 2010 and 2014, apart from a couple of short stories and letters to editors, I really wasn't getting anything. So I felt that my writing had plateaued and I needed some help.
Yeah.
So I took the decision to do a master's in creative writing, which I did part-time, distance learning. And that was a game changer.
And who was that with?
It was with Lancaster. The thing that really made it was we were put into syndicate groups. So I was working with four other people like me who wanted to get published. And we had to critique each other's work.
Yeah, that group critique.
That was so good that I am still sharing work with three of them. We graduated in, I think it was 2015.
Yeah.
And we're still sharing work on a regular basis. And that's just the most valuable thing for me. So if I can give them a name check, because they're fantastic.
Of course. Yeah, please.
One of them is called Jessie Payne. She's just signed with an agent. Fergus Smith, he's got some fantastic self-published novels, really brilliant, some military stuff, fantastic. And Peter Garrett, who writes wacky sci-fi, and he's published by Luna Press.
Brilliant. Oh, wow.
Brilliant.
Excellent.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Because
it's quite an interesting range of genres, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, but it's interesting because we've touched on this a lot in the podcast because quite a number of our authors have been through the University of East Anglia MA in crime writing and buddied up in that way, you know, and still...
Yes, and still are.
And their manuscripts go through those hands before they come to us, tend to. And also, when we were talking to William Shaw at Slaughter in Southwold, his contemporaries, he has a little group, C.J. Sampson is one of his...
Right,
contemporaries, and they bounce each other. I mean, you know, he's very ill at the moment, as many of us know. But, you know, that's sort of it's invaluable when you have those relationships, people you trust, opinions you trust, who can help you spot things that you hadn't perhaps, or give you the confidence to drive on. So, yeah, that's terrific. In terms of when that validation and, you know, eventually you got published and got a big publisher behind you, what was that feeling like after all that, you know?
Well, it's kind of bewilderment, really, bemusement, because you just don't really know really what you've got. You just kind of just carry on doing the same thing, because everything is so slow. So by the time I'd got the deal for my first novel after that, I was sort of two more novels down the road writing. You don't really realise it, I don't think. I think you just got to keep going with the writing and just have faith in your publisher for everything else.
Long may that be the case. I hope we can fulfil that as one of your publishers. In terms of your day, then, when you're writing, what do you aim for? When you're, you know, if you're committed to, you know,
I don't have a word count.
No,
never ever had a word count. I just when I'm doing a first draft, I write a chapter. So I don't know how long a chapter is. I don't really pay much attention to that. But I work, because I'm full time now, I just get to my desk about 9 o'clock. I work through till about 5 o'clock, really.
Mm-hmm.
I just do what I can. I mean, a lot of it, as you get more published, a lot of it is engaging on social media, actually. Yeah. And liaising with other writers and trying to read other writers' works and do reviews of other people's stuff, really. building
the network.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of it is that.
In terms of direct contact from readers, because you know, you presumably do you get emails from people directly?
One or two, yes. Not masses, but yeah, I've had one or two. I'm building up contacts with some lovely bloggers, some fantastic bloggers.
I totally love the bloggers.
Yeah.
Well, they're the oil that makes the thing move. I mean, really. Yeah. I mean, where it's hard to imagine the publishing industry without them now, but they weren't there 15 years ago in any formal sense. They might have, you know, provided, you know, a magazine or something like that, you know, printed out on a Bandit machine or something sent out. But it is extraordinary just how valuable and influential they've now become.
And so willing. When I when I approached them the first time, it was my publisher said, here's a list of bloggers, go and... And I thought, well, what's a blog tour? What's a blog? What do you know? What are you going on about? So he gave me a list of about 100, and I looked up each of them, and I only approached the ones that said they'd got space and also wrote books like the sort of thing I was writing, read books like I was writing. And they were so lovely, and I thought, they're going to think, who's this random nobody contacting them about her book? And they were so nice and helpful and really supportive. Even the ones who didn't have time to read it said, write me a post and I'll put it on my blog. Just fantastic. And this is now the fourth book that I'm engaging with the bloggers with. Still fantastic. And new bloggers coming on all the time who want to help.
Yeah,
it's just great.
We rely on them.
I talk to them about all sorts. I tell them what I'm cooking. I tell them what the cat's doing. They're friends now.
Yeah, and I find it quite. I mean, you know, this is bigging ourselves up, but when we sometimes meet the bloggers at festivals and whatever, they're so excited to meet Rebecca and I because you know they listen to the podcast or the. I find that.
And it's funny, is it? Because in my head, I'm thinking, do I know you? It's because they recognise me, but I don't recognise them. Then they say, it's Leslie. And I say, oh! And I get really excited then.
Yeah,
because I know who you are now.
But what's worth saying is they're doing this for nothing.
Yeah, they are,
We don't pay them to do this. No. Nobody pays them to do this.
True.
They have day jobs. They have children. They have
lives.
Elderly parents. They are busy people.
Yeah.
And yet they still find time to do really decent, thoughtful reviews.
Yes, they do. And actually, it's quite grounding and humbling for all of us. You know, it doesn't, you know, I don't think it behoves any of us to get carried away with egos and all that sort of thing. I think that's essentially what Hobeck's all about, actually, is just, you know, it's being real rather than... Because it's interesting, you go to something like Crime Fest, as we did, you know, a few months ago, and there's a split. Some of the authors can be a little bit, you know, can be a little bit egotistical, if dare I say it. One or two sort of carry themselves off as the great I am. And then you meet someone who's actually sold 10 million books, and they're as humble as...
Lovely Anne Cleves.
Yeah, exactly. There's a good example. I mean, she's grand... I mean, you know, as she's a quiet individual, goes to all these things, supports the industry, goes to lots of libraries, does tons of stuff like that, and yet very approachable, very humble. And yet, you know, she's done very well financially out of it. But still, to her, the thing that dominates her thoughts is her late husband.
Mm.
And very open about that and the impact it's had on her life. Mm. So, yeah, it's fascinating. I ought to ask, really, in terms of influences, is there one author that stands out for you who's you know, really inspired you?
I mean, I'm just going to say Agatha Christie, aren't I? Who doesn't? I wasn't a big reader as a young person. Didn't learn to read until I was 8, so reading was always a chore for me. And I didn't. I think I read an Agatha Christie when I was about 11. I didn't really read it properly, but we had to take a book from the library.
Yes, indeed.
I recognised the name because I'd seen Margaret Rutherford on the telly. So,
right.
But it did stay with me. So when I was old enough, and I'm talking about, frankly, in my 30s, to read a full novel, I gravitated straight to Agatha Christie. So I would say, really, that's the inspiration.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people we've spoken to have said the same thing, and then there's others who viscerally can't stand Agatha Christie, which is, I'm surprised that there is a sort of Marmite quality to her work. But one person turned around, or quite a famous author, and I can't remember exactly who, said, "Yeah, what she writes is so cold." You know,
it might actually have been Anne Cleves.
I think it was.
Yeah,
it was. It was Anne Cleves at Crime Fest who said that.
She said, "You're going to be surprised by my answer, but."
Yeah, because we asked her about whether Agatha Christie had played a part, because we'd just been to Devon and to the collection in Exeter.
But I would say she's the queen of plots. Because you've got to remember, we read stuff these days with ingenious plots, but she was writing from, is it the mid-20s onwards? So
she was.
She laid the ground with all these plots. I mean, all these stories that we have about people on a remote island and the numbers dwindle as somebody
locked room crime stuff, you know.
Absolutely.
On a train.
Yeah, she invented that idea, didn't she?
So I think you've got to give her credit for her plot.
See? I think so too. Yeah. I think so too. And it's what was so interesting, what we found out in Devon, was just how neurotic she was. On top of her huge success, how obsessed with every single shilling that she was owed being paid to her, even though she was a millionaire, multi-millionaireess. Extremely wealthy, you know, beyond dreams, really, of the time, but still obsessed with cash. We ought to get around. I was going to ask more about where we're taking the series next, actually. That's my sort of penultimate question, because the random question is around the corner. What next for Steph?
I've got a working title for the next one of Her Charming Man.
Ooh.
Ooh.
And we see Steph investigating two crimes. One is the murder of a journalist.
Yeah.
And the other is the disappearance of a middle-aged man. A charming man.
A charming
According to his wife, he's a charming man. And again, two crimes that seem totally unconnected. But it's got, in terms of the location, which is this sort of twist on Gloucester, I'm going to have Glevham Cathedral.
Yes.
So there's something going to happen in the grounds of Glevham Cathedral. And I'm also going to take Steph off to Sharpness. I recently went to the open day for the Severn Area Rescue Association, which is like the RNLI, but for rivers.
Right.
And I went to an open day and I had a talk there by one of the men who works for the rescue team, and it was so interesting. I thought, I'm going to get this in the book. So I'm going to have Steph have to go down there and interview them, not because they're involved in the case, but because they've helped look for somebody in the river. So I thought, you know, that's a chance to highlight what they do.
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a peculiar river, the Bore and all that stuff, you know, the tidal nature of it. It's an extraordinarily dangerous piece of water.
Yes. So I thought, you know, that was a chance to do a little bit of that.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Right. Okay. It is time for the random question now. I think this is, it's worrying for you. It's worrying for me because I don't know what it is. And Rebecca always worries that she's got to try and remember it.
I was going to say to you, have you ever forgotten it?
Not yet.
But you have.
But I usually think of it on the way to wherever we're going.
But on a couple of occasions when we've grabbed people at festivals,
we
had to do them on the fly.
That's been hard.
But anyway, time for the deep voice. Rebecca's random question.
Okay, your house is on fire. Every living creature from your house is safe, but what would you save? What is the one thing you'd save if you could save one thing from your house?
The memory stick with my PhD on. I'm in third year of 3.5 years of PhD, so I've got a 100,000-word thesis that's in its final draft.
Can we ask what it's on?
It's a creative writing PhD, so there is an 80,000-word novel, which is a literary work, and then a 20,000-word thesis on trauma appropriation, which is basically asking what right does an author have to depict trauma in a novel when it's not their own personal trauma. So you're appropriating the trauma of real people for entertainment.
Brilliant.
I'd like to read that.
Well, soon to be Dr. Ray Sargent.
Oh, I wish. I've got still got a while to go yet.
Yeah. Now I have this image of you running out the house saying, I've got it.
That's, so I hope it's backed up elsewhere in the cloud.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, please back it up somewhere else.
Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. And as we always say, I mean, we'd love to meet our authors in person.
Oh, it's been lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming.
And the sun's come out.
I'm actually starting to roast now. I can feel my forehead.
And now
burning.
You can see why I set...
Yes.
Her deadly friend in this wonderful garden.
Yeah. So just to remind you, we are with Rachel Sargent. We are at the Painswick Rococo Gardens. You must come if you're in the area. If you're passing down, like we do very regularly, to Devon and Cornwall, stop off here. It's brilliant.
Yeah, don't go to Gloucester Services. Come here.
Yeah. Yeah, forget Gloucester Services, which is like a magnet to me. But it's, you know, £15.
Well, this has a lovely Chorizo. Cafe with very fresh ingredients.
So cheaper than Gloucester Services.
I've got to ask, before we go, this isn't a random question. What do you think of Gloucester Services, being a local?
I've only been to it once.
Right.
Because it is so local that if I'm going on a journey, it's
why would you stop there?
I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to stop further down.
He makes a stop every time. Every
you
time.
Love it too.
I used to. I've gone off it.
Have you? Why?
Because it's so expensive. And
the toilets are marvellous.
It's always full of people in, I don't know, check shirts and sea salt tops. And
salmon trousers.
Yeah, salmon.
Yes, that's true. It is full of that. But it's also full of dogs. Because they've got loads of dog walks
around
there.
You can't get a normal Diet Coke. It's a
No, you can't. It's a Fentimans thingy or a brew. Yeah, version of a Diet Coke. Okay. We talked about Gloucester Services. I've got it off my chest. I do love that place.
He does. It looks like Teletubby Land as well.
It does a bit. It does a bit. But anyway, look, Rachel, it's been an absolute pleasure. Yeah, and thank you also to Nigel, who sat reading his book about White Russian gold over there.
He looks very content, though.
Well, he's got
he?
A baseball cap. I wish I'd brought mine out because I'm roasting now. But it's been fantastic. So congratulations. Good luck with Her Deadly Friend. It's out this week. Please, our wonderful Hobcast listeners, go to our website to buy a paperback. Go to Amazon to buy the ebook. And eventually, at some point, the audiobook will be available somewhere. Sometime in the future.
And tell us what you think, too. We'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's very, very important. But, you know, we're up for any feedback you have for our authors and for ourselves at any time. But, Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
So she would save her memory stick with her thesis on it. From a fire?
Of course, you got me thinking because originally I was thinking, what would I say? And I was thinking, you know, I've got precious photo albums. I've got memories from the children. I thought, do you know what? My laptop. Because in the last 20 years, 15 years or so, all the important photographs are actually on the laptop.
Yes.
And well, obviously Hoebeck. I would have to save Hoebeck and that's on my laptop.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure what I'd save. Something sentimental, but I haven't really got a lot of sentimental stuff really. I don't have pictures of my kids here. I don't really, do
no.
I?
No, you should get some pictures of them.
I know. Well, you know, at some point, but I'm not sure. There must be a book that I would save, or possibly my phone. I guess I'm attached to that most of the day, it seems. Anyway, lovely to speak to Rachel. Her Deadly Friend is out on Tuesday, as is Bullets in the Sand by A.J. Aberford, which is the second George Zammit thriller.
Yep.
And it's a cracker. And not so long away is Hawk at the Crossroads. That's coming out too. So he really has been busy.
Yes, and he's actually delivered book number 4 to us. So
That's one of the things I've got to get reading.
Wasn't a hint, by the way.
No, I know. But, I mean, boy, oh, boy, this week was one of the busiest we've ever had.
I don't think our feet touched the ground.
No, it was, honestly. I spent 3 days in in my mock-up engineering suite next to my
he
studio.
He makes it sound so posh.
We had a guest here. We had a guest here recording one of our audiobooks. And or at least contributing towards it as one of the main characters. We're doing it as a multi-voice production because quite simply it has to be authentic and spot on. And so that was what we did this week. So I spent 3 days basically directing that from outside my studio solidly.
Very intense, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was extremely intense, yeah. I mean, I was, you know, collapsing with exhaustion by about 7 o'clock in the evening.
I should have made the most of it, shouldn't I? And made you make decisions while you were too tired to care.
Yeah. And our second guest actor is coming later this coming week to do something similar, to play one of the other characters.
Yeah.
And I'm playing one of the characters as well. In fact, I'm playing several of them because I can turn myself to different voices, you see. And
can you really? Haven't you?
Yes, I can. I can do the Michael Caine, which is obviously Michael is going to appear in this. No, he's not.
I want one of our authors to add a cameo for Michael Caine, just so that you can do the narration.
Yeah, exactly. That would inspire me. But I mean, we are taking a different direction with audio as we speak, and so one of the things that's coming up next month is finalising potentially a deal with an agent to represent our audio. More about that when we get that done. But that's in the offing. So we have been busy. Boy, have we been busy. And, you know, with two books out this week, we'll continue to be busy.
So, I mean, just now, before recording the end of this podcast, I've been setting up the Facebook campaign for Her Deadly Friend.
Yeah. I'll be doing the same with the Amazon campaign before I go
to bed. Absolutely, yeah. So, no rest for the wicked.
Indeed not. And it's you know, it's exciting times. I love bringing books out and bringing them to, you know, publication. In fact, funnily enough, if you get yourself down to the Rococo Garden in the gift shop, you can already get Her Deadly Friend because they put it
signed
up early.
Signed copies too.
Signed copies too. Indeed.
With Hobet bookmark.
That was quite exciting. Anyway, thank you so much for your company this week. So next week is the appearance of Zoe Sharp, who is a great writer. She's been writing since 1988, she was telling us, in terms of nonfiction, and then into the fiction world, and is a really celebrated crime fiction author who is much sought after on the circuit for the festivals.
Yeah, she's got a lot of charisma, hasn't she?
Oh, tons.
And she's very sharp.
Well, yeah.
As well as being...
No, she's got an incredible... It's an incredible story. Her life story is fabulous. And she has so much... so many interests. She's, you know, a sort of a Renaissance woman in many ways.
And she has a fluffy cat.
She does. In fact, she has two. And we were... delighted to speak to her. So that's our interview next week on the Hobcast, episode 87. But thank you for joining us for episode 86 here today with Rachel Sargent. It's been an absolute pleasure. We've got the cat lolling on the carpet in front of us. If we encourage her, she might say something.
She's not. She's so content.
Yeah.
Did you feed her? Is that why she's so content?
No, I haven't fed her. No, no. It's time. She's been insisting on food since we got back. But no, she can wait. And indeed... so can we all for next week's episode. If you've enjoyed the Hobcast, please subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts from. It means a great deal to us as we build our army of listeners. Of course, go to our website, www.hobeck.net, for details of all our authors, our books, our audiobooks as well, the ones that we've produced to date. And really is just a chance for me, Adrian Hobart.
And me, Rebecca Collins.
To wish you a wonderful warm and creative week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.